This is Listener's Guide, a series from Big Secret Records. Each season leads you deep into how the label's releases were made with the artists who made them. I'm Andrew Jones, the owner and operator of Big Secret Records, talking to you from the label's home base in Portland, Oregon. You're listening to How Good American Songbook by Bob Cummins Jr. was made, and we are almost to the end of the season. This is the penultimate song on the album. It's called Here and That's All Right. Penultimate means second to last for those of you who might be studying for your SATs. You might want to write that on your hand. A little crib note, courtesy of me. We're going to talk about how British people might discuss McDonald's, Paul McCartney giving himself a warm hug. Debussy pokes his head in again on this one. You might remember him coming up in our conversation in the episode on Could You Be My Magic Arm? And we're also talking about big, loud bass amps. Oh, yeah. Enjoy.
I don't remember those times in the studio with...
Here and That's All Right, we did... I know there was just, like, a lot of planning that went into it. Like, a few minutes of talking of, like, how are we going to do this? Because that song had those three really distinct sections.
I recorded the, like... The beginning, and then like without a click, and then I think we listened to that in the studio, and then we all did that first jam together, and then we did the second jam, and then I recorded the little interlude part.
I don't remember that session as much. I remember very, very, very vividly the tube sounds.
Oh yeah,
that was really what stuck with me from that song.
I remember asking you to bring a bunch of stuff that was just like really non-traditional, and
that tube thing is one of my favorite memories of recording, just because I didn't realize how hard I was going.
Oh yeah, and Andy's just
video where I'm like swinging my ass off and Andy's just barely moving. and it's mixed so prominently.
Yeah.
It's, and it sounds so cool, but
Yeah, when we kind of like Raymond pulled them out and I was like, "Oh, what are these? This is interesting." And he like just like swung it once and I was like, "That's it. Like that's so fucking weird. We got to do it." And you know, so we went in and did it, and then when I heard it on playback, I was like in tears. Like, this is so weird and beautiful, and it sounded just so strange and like wistful. That, like, you know, it added this dimension to the song without like taking it in a new direction.
Right.
But it was very unique. You know, like it was totally unique to the song. It doesn't come up again. They don't appear on the album ever. Yeah, that's one of my favorite parts, because when they creep in, it's like it's kind of menacing. It's eerie a little bit, but it just adds to the sort of, I don't know, like melancholia or sadness or whatever you want to feel for that part.
But if you saw what it's coming from.
Yeah, these like neon,
right.
Hilarious juxtaposition.
Right.
Yeah, these neon tubes,
fake instrument,
like weird thing.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
And what's funny too is that we're just like totally lucky that those were in tune.
Yeah.
Right.
The song, but now I know, and for future reference for anyone using Whirly tubes, that you can just cut them.
I don't necessarily think of it as like a sad song. I mean, like it can be sad if you like hear it that way, but I think you could hear it in a few different ways.
It has some joy to it too. Like there's like
Well, it's interesting. I hate mentioning McCartney so much, but
we should just refer to him by a different name.
Yeah, Macca. My brothers were, or my brother Sam was like, yeah, I wonder if it would be funny if in Britain they're like, whenever they go to McDonald's, they're like, "You want to go to Mackey's? There's a new burger and chips at Mackey's." Anyway, whenever he writes a sad song or like an emotional song, I feel like John likes to wallow in his misery quite a lot. Whereas McCartney, it seems like he likes to write a self-soothing, comforting song.
Sort of giving himself a hug.
Right, exactly. And I think that's kind of what that was.
I just want to point out for the Easter egg of this whole podcast recording as well that you're wearing a Beatles shirt, right?
I am wearing a Beatles shirt. I am.
Like a Beatles con exclusive shirt,
too. Right. It's like a shirt from a Beatles convention that looks like a Creed shirt. But it's not a joke. It's not a joke. It's from like 2001, and I guess they were trying to like modernize the Beatles, and it's just aged honestly very well. I think it looks like a Lord of the Rings poster if it were made by an amateur.
And there are four flaming hearts on it. That's the real, like, what the hell?
It looks like a photo that would be up in Buzz Brew if any Dallas listeners are tuning in.
I remember you nailing that the third movement of that song, where it's very, is rubato the word? It's, like, very, like, free and loose, and it's not really time.
Oh, right. Yeah, I actually got very frustrated. I don't know if that carried over and y'all saw it, but I mean I had to do that part so many times. Yeah. The middle part.
I
yeah,
I remember you doing it a few times.
That's right.
And actually
I spent like 30 minutes just going like, let's do it again, let's do it again.
But I remember
it was worth it.
I think I wanted to give it that Debussy thing where the tempo really does not matter. Or I mean, I guess it matters, but you know, it's not, it's going in and out of fast and slow
tempo.
Right. Exactly.
And that's the end of that song. I feel like I remember there being a lot of darting eyes back and forth of like, when do we come in?
Right.
You know, like when I listened to it and like the way we dropped in and everything, like it just feels so good to me.
Yeah.
And it's one of those endings where I think it's just a 2-bar phrase, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I could listen to that for like another 10 minutes. And I think it just, did we fade it out?
Yeah, we ended up fading it, but it did go on for like a couple minutes, didn't it?
Yeah, it went on for like a minute and a half.
Yeah.
And then after y'all... It might have been after Raymond and Jasper left, but Andy laid down the acoustic for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just sat in the booth and wept. It was just so, so pretty. Now I get tired of it.
So many times. Yeah, this song, fuck.
I think this is also one of the first ones I did like a bunch of overdubs on, right?
Yeah, does the ending of that song have, or no, the middle part, the that has you doing two feel. Right, and you have that like tambourine thing on your hi-hat.
There's like a tom thing going on, and then there's like a brush part underneath, and it was one of the first like this. I think this was the first session I used those drums on, so it was really cool because
hearing
those in that song in particular, I was like, yes, I made a good decision buying these.
Yeah.
They sound so cool to me, and like the way you engineered it, just like it's another moment where it feels like you just plucked it out of my brain.
I don't even remember what my original drum part on that was, but those tom parts are just part of the song now. Mm. And what setup did you use for the bass, Jasper?
I used a round wound P bass with... Andy pulled the amp forth. I don't remember what the amp was, but it was this big, like, loud fucking amp.
It was probably a Trainer amp, because I wanted to use an Ampeg V4B, but it wasn't there, and so it was probably, like, in the shop or something, and, like, the next choice for me is a Trainer. I forget the model number, but it
sounds
just
so fat.
Yeah, it's very just big sounding, and I turned it way the fuck up, like, I remember we had a kind of a monitoring situation because it was so loud, and Jasper was like, could you like turn me down or turn me up in my headphones somehow? Like, can we turn the amp down? Because it was like, I mean, it just filled the room.
Yeah.
And
oh man, you could feel the air moving with that amp. Like,
and it was behind a baffle. Like, we had Raymond in the ISO booth, and then it was just Jasper and a piano in the live room. And we had, you know, put a blanket over the piano, and like I put the top like at the lowest point so we could still have mics in there. And I was still worried about like the bass like really bleeding into those mics, but we ended up finding a happy medium, but it was still the loudest thing in the room.
Any liberties with that bass part, or
it was by the book.
Okay.
It was,
because I remember being pretty particular about that bass part, and I kind of felt bad being like, yeah, this is what you play.
But because that song is very composed, and this kind of goes back to Raymond's overdubs. It's very like, I look back on that recording and it feels very like orchestral to me. Even when it's like groovy and whatnot, like it feels very like, every part plays just enough to like get the whole thing feeling right and nothing more. And yeah, the bass line that you gave me was perfect for the song. So.
Well, I think I just didn't want anything to be doing too much, you know? Like, it's funny that you say it sounds composed, because it's like three chords and everything's just kind of playing it straight, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
It's interesting too. I when I charted that song out, I think it's one of those times where I was like, verse one, and then you started the next section, and I was like, still verse one.
Yeah, maybe it's just orchestral, you know, like, or because it's just.
What do you call a chorus?
Well, that song went through so many, like when writing it, and went through so many, like the beginning of that song was another song, and then I think. I like spliced at least two different songs together to make that, because they happened. I think it was like within the same couple of days. I was just writing in a certain tempo in E major, and two different songs happened to come out, and I had to workshop it a lot to get it to where it was, or where it would be, but. Yeah, the writing process of that song took a ton of transformations.
Together with that final progression and the way that the melody is written, it's like this is the final statement, and that kind of coda part, you know, like it could just end with the vocal, you know, with that last line, but the way that it keeps going is just like, this is an unresolved thought still, like this is something you're gonna keep thinking about, and that song is so beautiful to me.
Just when you sing the title, fucking wrecks me. Yeah. I think when I was recording it, I was just like, I had to stop because I was like,
it's very Ram Dass. I think I was listening to a lot of Ram Dass. It just sounds like if you took like a Ram Dass thing or talk and then put it into an AI, just had it like say a random word and a random phrase, it would be that. But the ending of that song is it was originally, like you were saying, composed, but I decided to dig into my bag of tricks for the ending when we were recording it, from my time as a jazz vocalist in high school. And there's some scatting at the end if you listen closely. A little special scat just for you.
I remember you were talking about like that was like a way into to working on your improvisation.
Yeah.
Right. It was like kind of singing it while you play.
Yeah. That's what Keith Jarrett does. That's
yeah.
Sing while you play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Except he sounds like a crazy person when he did it. Oh, rest in peace.
Could you imagine him with Art Blakey?
Yeah. And Thelonious Monk maybe like dancing on stage.
All right, we start goofing off around this point, but we can get serious with Amari, who returned to talk about her contributions to Here and That's All Right.
Yeah, well, he knew what he wanted with getting you on those tracks, and I think it was the right call. Like,
shocked and honored. I'm like, you really want me to come and sing and play? Are you sure?
But no, yeah, I think I think you both kind of showed like that you can vibe well together. I also want to plug your album Evolution that he played a lot on. That's all available on streaming, and he played a big role kind of later in there when we were really starting to track. He just jumped on and played along with a lot of the songs as we were recording them.
Yeah, he did. Just added his own flair and totally took Exhale to like a whole new life.
Yeah.
If I could choose, especially like Here and That's All Right, I feel like I would want that song to be like the soundtrack to the ending of like my life movie or something. That's what it feels like to me. Makes me get teary-eyed every time.
Yeah.
And like some of the songs I wish like I could write. I'm like, how? This is so beautiful. It's his lyrical ability. It's like, I'll have to listen to it a few times. I'm like,
yeah.
What did you mean by that? Like, I listened to it a few times. I'm like, that was so beautiful and clever.
Yeah, and when he mixes those sort of like clever aspects with just being really to the point, it's even more like surprising.
For me, I guess like the whole thing feels like if someone was literally going to sit you down and like show you clips and glimpses of like your life up until where you are, and just tell you like, look, everything wasn't so bad. Like, you got through it. Everything, it's okay. You're going to be okay. You're here where you are, and like, that's that. It's like, I've never heard anything like it, especially like the part, what were you guys using again? Those like whirly tubes to get like that eerie, beautiful little backdrop sound. I've never heard anything like that.
Yeah.
At first I didn't believe you guys like made that sound, but then when I saw the video on Instagram, I was like, you guys really were in there twirling it.
It all comes back to the tubes, folks. The tubes will lead you home. Subscribe to the podcast to learn about the rest of Good American Songbook track by track. Visit BigSecretRecords.com or find the label on Instagram and TikTok to learn more about what's next from the label. Thank you for listening.